Okay, well, we've got quite a treat. We've got three talks from Subhadramati, Kulamitra, and Vadranatha, and I'm assuming, I'm thinking maybe these are going to be three quite different talks, quite distinctive talks, knowing a little about the three speakers. I may be wrong, of course. But, you know, very different backgrounds, very different temperaments, very different paths that they've gone along in terms of their Dharma life, from what I've seen. And the way that they've taken the Dharma out to others, quite different as well. And actually, in terms of the theme, I think, quite different relationships, personal relationships to Bhante as well, historically. So I'm very much looking forward to these talks. I'm sure there's going to be some commonalities, one would assume that. yes, well chosen group of speakers, Subhadramati. So Subhadramati, you're going to start first.
I mean, I thought it was
Kulamitra. Ah, Kulamitra. Kulamitra's going to start first. I'm not going to say much, but I Kulamitra is one of these order members I sort of feel I know, but I haven't actually spent any time with, which is weird. But I did remember going to visit you in your home or community with Bhante, remember that? Years ago, 30 years ago, something like that. Amazing. And actually this context has given me a chance to sort of get a feel for Kulamitra, and I particularly impressed, actually, I must say, with that presentation you did, your PhD, you know, the rock caves of the early Buddhists. I think others would remember that. There was something very effective in the way, your enthusiasm. But also, you know, in a sense, I got a very definite impression of a very fine, critical mind. I'm hoping now we're face-to-face, we will get a better chance to spend time together. I also came across something a couple of days ago, just by chance. I was looking up some of the seminars, and there's a seminar that Bhante did on the survey. And he starts by saying, Kulamitra suggested that I get the study group leaders together. I'm not sure why. that's right. And I was still just out of high school, I think. So I think Kulamitra's got a very deep history with the movement. And it's quite funny because Bhante starts like that, but he's obviously convinced about the why as it proceeds. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm glad you remember that. Anyway, Kulamitra.
Okay. I'll probably start standing just because it's easier on my back in some ways.
Paramartha, is it recording?
It is.
So the first thing I have to say is in typically efficient presidential fashion, Lokabandhu told me I had half an hour for this, and I only found out last night when I said it seems quite a short period for the talks that he was expecting me to do it in 15 to 20 minutes, so we shall see. First thing I want to say is, yes, I do think that inspiration and responsibility are clear and distinct kind of strands. Inspiration, though, it's interesting, what does it mean? You know, it can mean something as little as motivating. You know, as in, your talk was inspiring, or I feel inspired to, you know, go and help Sanghadeva with the garden. But it can mean a lot more than that, and of course Bhante linked it to the second stage of dhyana. He named that the stage of inspiration. And interestingly, Nietzsche has a very good description of a clearly altered state of energy and vision, which he calls inspiration. So bear in mind that that is probably a sort of better or deeper way of looking at it. And when I started thinking about this talk, I thought, actually, those two strands, they're not entirely separate. I think they're like the double helix that they discovered in DNA. You know, they circle, they spiral round, and every so often they intersect and interact with each other. So I hope that'll come through in what I have to say. So I'll start with early inspiration. When I was 16, I started having spontaneously different dhyanic, really, states of mind occurring when I was alone in nature. And that intensified somewhat when I travelled on my own. When I travelled on my own, sometimes they lasted for days at a time. But at the same time, that was quite confusing, because then I would come back to my ordinary everyday life and wonder, what the hell happened? You know, why can't I be like that all the time? Because they were, you know, clearly not only more positive, but there was a deeper sense of value in those states, a deeper sense of understanding. So when I came across the Dharma, I really was inspired. And I was inspired by the teaching, but I was inspired by the people as well. So I came along in Norwich, I met people like David Mitra, Sona, Abhaya, and others. And I just immediately could see these people are doing what I want to do, or what I thought I needed to do. And I know I was inspired, because that winter in Norfolk, as the wind came in from the North Sea, straight from the Siberian steppes, I never felt cold. It was as if I had an inner energy all through that first winter. I was very inspired. And more or less coterminous with that, I started to take responsibility in the Norwich Centre. So I used to come along before the classes and talk to Dave Mitra. And one day he looked at his watch and said, oh, I must go and get the tea and biscuits for the class. He grabbed some money out of the Dharma bowl and went to the little shop across the road. And I thought, that can't be right. You know, he hasn't accounted for that money. He doesn't know how much has come in before it's going out. So I must have said something. And in a very short period of time, I was treasurer of the centre, treasurer of the community, and treasurer of the right livelihood business. And I was very young. This was before I was ordained. I was 21. And it's interesting because on one hand, I could clearly see things like that and take responsibility for them. On the other hand, I was quite an irresponsible young person in a way. So I got myself in a little bit of difficulty, which I can confess now, no one knew at the time. So in the Right Livelihood business was a little restaurant in Norwich. It was no more than a cafe, really. So we couldn't expand that in the premises. So we decided to go around and do some of the fairs, the festivals around Norfolk. And we bought catering equipment and a marquee, and they went quite well. But, of course, I was in charge of the finances, and I hadn't realised that the better they went, the more equipment we needed for the next one. And at one point, I had borrowed the community's rental money without telling anybody, which fortunately that fair did okay, and it was there in the bank by the time the rent was due. But it was a close-run thing. So I think that's quite interesting. You know, on the one hand, in the movement, it was very clear that if you didn't do something, something wouldn't happen. But on the other hand, we were very young, and our ability was quite limited, our understanding was quite limited. And that carried on for me. So I was headhunted by Subhuti at the end of the building work on the London Buddhist Centre, and he wanted me to come down and run the co-op, you know, because I'd had Right Livelihood experience. And I came down to London, and I was, I think it was secretary of the co-op. And Prakasha was the treasurer, and we shared an office. And I remember coming into that office so many times, and Prakasha would just sit there all day long doing his accounts. And he'd look up at me and he'd say, Kulamitra, what do you do? And it was fantastic. It was a really good challenge, because I didn't know what I was doing. And at a certain point, I realised that I was not in a position to be running a co-op. So I stepped down and I went to work in what remained of the building team, which was great. I learnt how to do pointing. I didn't have any, you know, admin responsibilities. But at a certain point, after I'd been doing that for about 6 months, Subhuti asked me to go for a walk with him. I knew it wasn't a social occasion. And we went for a walk around Victoria Park, and he said to me, look, Lokamitra needs a lot of money. He needs to do social work as well as Dharma work in India. And he needs £50,000. I mean, that's more than Lokamitra raised when he was in Pundarika, far more, to go towards the building work of the LBC with all those jumble sales. It was an enormous amount of money. And Subhuti said, we're looking for someone a bit mad to take it on. So I did, because I knew I wasn't going to be a builder for the rest of my life, and here was an opportunity. Why not? I wasn't initially very successful, and again, people would say, how much have you raised? And the answer was nothing, until I hooked up with Tim Lilly, and we got the door knocking going for what was Aid for India, and eventually became Karunar. At the same time, I wanted to work in a centre, really. So when Prakasha left as chair of the LBC, I saw an opportunity. I knew I wasn't ready for it, but I also knew it wasn't going to come round again, you know, just because I was suddenly ready for it. The LBC needed a sort of compromise candidate, I think. Deva Mitra had put himself forward as the next chair, but this wasn't very popular in some quarters. And so I found myself the chair. I put myself forward, and I was the chair of the LBC for the next 5 years. And again, in some ways, I wasn't really ready for it. I think I was more ready than anybody else, but that didn't say very much anyway. And I remember noticing that every time Bounty came to the centre, all these people around me, this very fractious council with strong opinions and different ideas, strong personalities, would all sort of gather around Bounty in this harmonious way. And I remember talking to him about that one time. And he said, well, yes. He said, really, you need to be, as chair, you need to be, especially in a big centre like this, you need to be head and shoulders above the rest. But you're not. You know, so I did my best. I managed it for about 5 years. And I think I did a good job. But it was pretty wearing. And in many ways, it was beyond, you know, my capacity. I think I'd understood a lot about Bounty's teaching and how he structured the movement. But emotionally, in terms of relating to people and that kind of thing, I was way behind the curve. So how did I keep inspired during that period of intense effort? Well, in some ways, I did find the LBC itself an inspiring place to be. I often found myself in a dhyanic state leading puja in the big shrine room and things like that. And also, it was very good for me. I mean, it was very challenging. I worked with people like Dharmarati and Parami, teaching, eventually leading retreats, you know. So I think that's an important part of taking responsibility, that it probably works much better if it's good for you as well as good for others, if it's part of your personal growth. But I did go on quite a lot of retreats. I mean, those were the days when, you know, you got 6 weeks retreat a year and you took them. So I remember going on a convention. Only, I think, two of you will have been there. I think it's probably before Padmasuri's time. But Dharmarati and Prakasha certainly could have been there. It was Vine Hall. And Bounty led, one after the other, one evening after the other, all the sadhana practices, the main ones to do with the mantras. You were there. Great. Good.
Me?
No. Yashodeva was already there. So that was very inspiring. And I always took it that after that, that as it were, I had permission to do those sadhana practices because I'd gone through them with Bounty. And I did often do them, particularly as well as my own practice, Padmasambhava. I did the Tara practice and the one or two of the other ones, mainly Vajrasattva. And I did those on retreats at Vajraloka. I went on quite a lot of... Well, they were called retreats, but they were... It was basically like a meditation community in those days. You just went and participated. There was no teaching or theme or anything like that. And I also did quite a lot of solitaries, increasing the time until I did, I think, a month solitary. And particularly on that month solitary, I had some very strong experiences in one or two of the sadhanas where it was no longer me doing it. It was me living it. So, you know, on the one hand, I had quite a tough nut in this rather big, fractious LBC. But on the other hand, you know, when I was on my own, I could get back to a more dhyanic state. I came to the end of my time at the LBC and unexpectedly found myself wanting to go and see whether I could live in Africa again. I was brought up there as a child, and it had a very strong emotional impact on me. So when I said I had to step down from the LBC, that came up, and I did. I went back there for 6 months. It didn't work out. It was the wrong time and the wrong place for me. And what made it absolutely clear that it hadn't worked was that at the end of that 6 months, I had a car crash. I was driving. I was with my parents in my dad's Range Rover. And there were a lot of potholes in the road. So we slowed down, and eventually they seemed to end. We picked up speed again. And suddenly there was a pothole. I mean, as big as the car. We're talking, you know, you couldn't go into it. So I swerved, but I never got control back of the car. And eventually, it went upside down and span. I know because it was upside down when I came to and pointing in the wrong direction down the road. I don't know how often it rolled and span. But we were all okay. Miraculously, you know, we were fine. We survived. The car was a write-off. We got back to the city. But in the following days, I thought, well, I've been meditating all this time. I want to go back into that experience. I can't remember what happened. And I did manage to do that, and I got a real shock. I think it was my first real insight experience. So when I went back into that experience, I could hear the sounds. I could see shards of coloured light, but there was no central eye to organise that experience in that moment. There was up to the point that the vehicle turned, and there was again as soon as I came to. I don't think I was ever unconscious, upside down in the driver's seat and clambered out the window with where the glass had vanished. But I found it deeply shocking. I mean, maybe for a few days actually I was in quite an open state after that. But then this very intense anxiety came in and lasted really for a long time. So to give you an idea how intense it was, I came back to England because I realised I needed to be back with my Sangha friends. But when I arrived back in England, my parents had a flat in Hampstead. And of course they weren't using it, they were in Africa. I went straight there to find my feet. My dad has a drinks cabinet. Now I don't really drink, especially not spirits, but I was very shaken up. So I thought, oh, I'll have a brandy. So I poured myself, you know, what for me would be a very stiff brandy, drank it down, and it had absolutely no effect. It didn't even intoxicate me, let alone take away the anxiety. So I thought, I'll have a second one, which I did. It had absolutely no effect either. And I suddenly realised why people become alcoholics. Because I realised that in order to obliterate my experience, I would have to drink the whole bottle. But what was worse, I'd have to do the same thing the next morning. And I'd have to keep on doing that. And that wasn't an option. So I had to live with that anxiety. I couldn't meditate on my own for quite a long time. So I started going to the LBC in the company of others in that wonderful shrine room, I could sort of settle and meditate. And, you know, eventually I came out of that. But I think, yes, it had a very profound and ongoing effect. That sort of anxiety is still with me. It's more manageable, if you like, but I'm not entirely clear of it, not entirely the other side. I can't yet rejoice in insight. It still has that scary element. And I went to see Bounty, of course, after that. And that was very interesting as well, because it was very clear to me, and I'm pretty sure it was clear to him as well, that I got to the point where I had to deal with myself. He couldn't really be of any help. This was my experience, and I had to deal with it. So that was very interesting. So I didn't go back to full-time work in the movement. I bought my first house. I studied at university. I started the North London Buddhist Centre. So, yes, I think, you know, my level of inspiration had in a way collapsed, but not my faith. I think that's quite different. And I'd always felt that, you know, we're very small. We're only a small part of things. And if we want to use that small part productively, we have to get leverage. So I thought, I'm not going to go back and live around the LBC and be an order member among 50 plus order members, you know, with nothing in particular to do. Let's see if we can get something started where I'm now living in North London, where I'll be one of very few order members, and we'll have to do something. So we did. And, you know, with four order members and about 10 mitras, we got a new centre off the ground. And that was very, I won't say inspiring in that higher sense, but it was very pleasing. It was great to see it flourish and work. And eventually I became chair of that centre a couple of times at the beginning and at the end of my period there. But a lot else was going on. I got married twice. The first marriage dissolved very, very quickly. But in both cases, it was really about having a family and having children. So I not only got married, but I had children. And then I found that single rich is family poor. So I had to start a small business to support my family. And, you know, that's very time-consuming. And we moved to Bath, well away from any... Well, there's a centre in Bristol, but we never really connected with that. So my life took a very different turn, but how did I try and keep up my inspiration during that period? I had a lot of responsibilities. They just weren't to the movement. I now had two young children, a wife, a family, a small business to run. That's a lot of responsibility. So how did I keep myself going? Well, the Butterfield Total Immersion Retreats had just started. And I must have been on three or four of those altogether over the years. The first one had Vasantra and Kamala Sheila co-leading, and then I went on some with Kamala Sheila. They were very, very good. I remember somebody saying to me, because they're mostly in silence, I remember somebody saying to me in the first couple of days when you do talk to people, oh, I guess you'll really miss your children. And I thought, well, maybe if I was here for 3 months, but not 3 weeks. No, you know, I'm just dying for that silence to descend, peace and quiet. So, yes, I sort of got my meditation practice going at a deeper level. And that was very interesting because what it did was it depth-charged quite a number of issues. So it didn't really take me back into dhyana and inspiration. It actually gave me more to work with. And the first of those issues that came up was rethinking my sexual relationship with Sangharakshita. Actually, I didn't really have to rethink it. A lot of anger came up about one particular incident. So, for those of you that don't know, I was asked to accompany Bhante to a European retreat which was being held in Sweden. He was not going to be on the retreat as such. He wanted to meet the people involved in Europe. I was going to be supporting Sona, who was leading the retreat. On the way over in the boat, Bhante seduced me. That was kind of okay, because I sort of knew those things were going on, and I'd already thought, well, if I trusted anybody to have a go at this weird homosexuality thing, it would be Bhante. So I kind of, you know, I wasn't sexually aroused, but I let it happen. But then when we got to Sweden, we were shown into the room that we were to share, and I was told that I was to bring him his cup of tea every morning before going to the meditation. So I did that. Got up every day, went to make his tea, brought it to him. So we had two single beds opposite sides of the room, and it was very enjoyable sharing the room with him, talking about the books I was reading, you know, that kind of thing. Until one day, I had a bit of time after I got in his tea. Of course, I had my tea, so I got back into bed to read my book for 5 minutes before going to the meditation. And he came over without saying anything and just got into the bed with me and had sex with me. And when that re-emerged on that retreat, I realised that I was really upset. It wasn't the right time and place for that sort of thing. It had had a very confusing effect on me because I was on retreat and I hadn't been able to say anything. That was the worst thing, that I should have said no. You know, probably if I had, that would have been respected. But because of the relationship, I didn't know how to say no. I wasn't emotionally mature enough. I was still only 23 or something at that point. Only just 23. So this all came up and I went to see Bhante, and I didn't get anywhere with it. It was a period when he was still absolutely convinced that all that he'd done in that area was completely skillful. And, you know, if I didn't think so, I'd sort of re-evaluated the wrong way. But I did pursue it, and it did affect my faith. It certainly affected, you know, how I sort of saw Bhante. But gradually I think I've been able to absorb that. And I think it's helped me to see that insight and humanity are also dual strands that kind of, you know, weave together. And it didn't sort of make me think he was an evil person. And it certainly couldn't deny the other sides of my experience, you know, his kindness, his mindfulness, his intelligence and all those things. But nevertheless, I felt that he needed to step off that pedestal and acknowledge what had happened. And fortunately, right at the end of his life, you know, when he was already half blind and half disabled and really not very well, I went to see him again. And although it was quite an odd meeting because he was so different from how I'd experienced him in the past, it led eventually to a sort of apology. He basically, at one point in the conversation, I went through it all again, and he said he didn't remember it, but if I said it had happened, he believed it must have happened. And I said to him, well, it was wrong, wasn't it? And he said, yes, it was wrong. Mm-hmm. So that was, you know, that really helped resolve things. Mm-hmm. But also I felt all along that I was doing that for his good as well. Mm-hmm. I felt it was very important for him not to take it to the grave. He needed to learn something, whatever it was from his point of view. So I was pleased that we got to that point. The other thing that came up on those total immersion retreats was how dissatisfied I was with my marriage. And I came back from one of those retreats and, you know, in my own clumsy way, tried to go into that and really failed. So I just realised, okay, well, my kids are still very young. I'm not going to leave at this point. We just carry on and make the best of it for the time being. But I think from that point on, I didn't see that as continuing forever. And it eventually led to our divorce. So where does that leave me? Well, I'm president of the North London Buddhist Centre, have been for a few years. And no, I don't think I've lost my faith. On one of these meetings, Naga Bodhi said to me, so, you know, did I still have faith in the order? I think he was thinking in terms of after Bhante's death and so on. And I laughed and I said, yeah, as much as I ever did. Because what does it mean? You know, you have faith, but at the same time, people are very flawed. You know, I know Bhante was, so all the rest of you must be. But my faith is in the Dharma. I really can't see any other way. You know, I couldn't go and drink myself to death. That was clearly not the answer. So I'm flawed too. What do I do about that? I keep going, I keep working on myself. But I would like to be more inspired. I do believe I have experienced a state of more energy, more vision, and I know that I'm not currently experiencing that. Although responsibility and inspiration, as I've described them circling around, often reinforce each other, I haven't mentioned sometimes they're in conflict. And I find myself in that sort of position at the moment. I had booked a retreat, a much-needed retreat after all the COVID era, you know, immediately after this. And I've had to cancel it because my eldest son has got in difficulties. He was beaten up at university and it's very current for him. And although I insisted against my ex-wife's judgment on coming here, I knew that we're in good communication here. If he really needed me, I could leave. But on a Buddha field retreat, that's not so easy. You're much more isolated. So I thought, no, can't really do that at this stage. So there can be conflict between responsibility and inspiration. And I think it's interesting, I'm not a lone figure. Some of you are living in communities, you know, living a very full-time Dharma life, but many, many, many order members are not. Far more than when I first came along, you know, when there were so few order members and so much to do. And one of the things I've been finding is it's very difficult for an order member to find something that would feed them, let alone inspire them, at a local centre. And I think this is a weakness we ought to address. I think it's almost as if we're still living in the past, still thinking that, you know, order members are getting everything from something else and going into a centre to teach. And I don't think it can be like that anymore. It certainly can't be for me. So I'm involved in North London Centre as president. I do go to activities there. But I've been trying to go along to the Bristol Centre. It's only just up the road from me. And I really can't find anything at the moment that is on anything like an appropriate level. I mean, they don't even have a sort of double meditation and puja night at the moment. And it's very clear that, you know, when they're in teaching mode, they're teaching sort of newish friends. And that may be appropriate for those people, but what about the order members? So they have very few order members involved in running the centre, an enormous number of order members who I never see in Bristol. So there's not even much of a sense of community. I mean, in all honesty, going along to Green Party social meetings, there's more of a sense of community than I'm picking up around the centre, which really shouldn't be like that. Now, North London is a bit different, and Ratnaprabha's Saturday morning class is a very good Dharma class, which works on numerous levels. And I know there is a double meditation class. But nevertheless, I think we don't think enough about how to keep order members inspired. And I'll leave it at that.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Well, I started saying that I'd like to get to know. That was really, really moving. Very precious, actually, all those stories. So just wonderful. Wonderful. Yeah. I'm not going to say anything more. Badranathan? Yeah, so I'm glad Badranath is here amongst this noble gathering. We go back 30 years at least, don't we?
Yes.
You see, Badranath is a friend. And those old caravans out the back of Padmaloka. Actually, the thing I remember about Badranath the most, you might find this a bit odd, is his laugh. I used to hear it echoing across the lawns. But Badranath and I are friends. I count him as a friend, and I've gotten to know him slowly over the years. Very passionate, disarmingly open. Very good friend. So.
Well, I only found out the talk was 20 minutes long when Paramatma introduced us. So I could do a bit of editing as I'm going along. I'd like to start off with the talk Bhante gave in 1999, which was called Looking Ahead a Little Way. And in that talk, he announced that he was going to be passing on the headship, or passing over the headship of the order to somebody else the next year, without saying who it was going to be. So obviously the talk had a lot to do with the lineage of responsibility, like passing on responsibilities. But the reason I looked up the talk when I was thinking about what I was going to say today was an image that he uses on that talk, which made a big impression on me at the time, which is this image of the Dharma being like a wave. And that's on a global level. Basically, the wave of Buddhism sort of reached its peak maybe about the time of Nalanda or something like that. And on a global level, Buddhism is in decline, that it's kind of dying out. And this is the Buddhist vision of the Dharma, that things will arise and pass away. And that includes the manifestation of the Dharma in the world, so that Buddhism is kind of basically dying out. And that Western Buddhism could be seen as like a small wave on top of that larger wave, which is just rising, but obviously that also be declining. So for me, I felt that this guy gives the kind of perspective of what I think I'm supposed to be doing as a president, as a completely new president. I feel I don't really know what I'm doing yet, but it's a bit like we're working with this inevitability of decline that our Buddhist centres will be tending to decline. The whole of Sri Ratna will disappear. This won't go on forever. So we're trying to sort of either slow down the process of decline a bit, or try and produce small upward waves within this process of decline. And so specifically with my centre, which is the Mérida Buddhist Centre in Venezuela, I feel that I've become president of a centre which actually has a broken lineage. So the lineages, which we would normally have in Sri Ratna, have been kind of quite severely broken. And in Latin America in general, it's very easy to see how Sri Ratna could completely disappear very, very quickly. You know, in South America, particularly where Venezuela is, there are only two small focuses. There's the Mérida Buddhist Center, which I helped to found many years ago, and there's Manjupriya in Brazil, and that's it. So if Manjupriya died, probably it would all fade out very, very quickly in Brazil, and the centre in Mérida could see all the work that we've done over the years there fading out very, very quickly as well. So I sort of see, not only is the lineage in some ways broken in that centre, but the conditions for its continuance are very, very weak, and in the whole of Latin America in a lot of ways as well, because I'm quite involved with Mexico. So although Mexico is very impressive in a lot of ways, there's a lot of people involved in the centre, a lot of people benefiting from the centres in Mexico. I also see quite a lot of factors which could bring about its kind of degeneration and disappearance sort of relatively quickly, much more quickly than we can imagine here in the UK. So what I thought I'd do in this talk is kind of look at the ways in which our lineages can degenerate and what we might be able to do about that. And using the kind of the good old models of near and far enemies. So looking at inspiration, responsibility, and their near and far enemies. Starting with inspiration. So I think the far enemy of inspiration would be dejection, despondency, pessimism. Right? So if we don't have inspiration, the exact opposite of it is those sorts of states of mind. So feeling that the wave is on its way down, things are dying out. What's the point of all this? What's the point of putting so much effort in trying to get a Buddhist centre running when we know it's all going to die out anyway? What's the point? And say, in the circumstances where I'm working in Venezuela, there's a very high degree of isolation from the rest of the movement. So I think it can be quite difficult for people to conceive that, so that the other nearest centres, they're both approximately 3,000 miles away. So Mexico towards the northwest and Sao Paulo towards the southeast. But not only is it sort of 3,000 miles away, but it's very long, complicated, expensive journeys as well. So there's a degree of isolation in Venezuela that's far greater than probably any other centre, actually. No, it's very, very isolated. And not only are the poor order members who are out there and Mitras extremely isolated from the rest of the movement, but the whole of society is breaking down. You know? So this, in terms of the waves of things rising and falling, it was a democracy, it's no longer a democracy. Just all the basic conditions for life are very, very difficult. The whole economy has fallen apart, the social structure of society has fallen apart. Millions of people left the country, literally millions of people left the country. I think it's the largest kind of exodus from a country in peacetime kind of ever, probably. And that the country feels empty, and the cities feel empty. And people have very little contact with the UK. So I think receive the message about giving this talk is one of the things I was asked to consider is like what do we do when people have not met Banti personally. But in Venezuela it's not so much a way of not meeting Banti, but they're very unlikely to come to the UK, very unlikely to come to Adisana. In Mexico itself, increasingly the ordinations are taking place in Mexico. The source of that. So, for me, coming here to Adisana, a source of very, very important inspiration. But my friends in Venezuela, for a whole host of reasons, it's quite possible that they will never be able to do that. You know, it's increasingly difficult for them to get visas. So it's very, very difficult to get visas to go anywhere. It's more up to now we've been getting them ordained through Mexico. But Mexico's now asking for a visa for Venezuela. What are they going to do to get their inspiration from somewhere else? So I think this the far enemy of inspiration is this kind of dejection, despondency. So rather than seeing the inevitable decay of things as being sort of the magnificent play of the Alia Vignana or or the spring flowers that coming to being and dying away, you can just get very, very low, just seeing everything going through the inevitable process of decay. And then the near enemy of inspiration is something that I think you could call individualistic inspiration. So you might have somebody who's got lots of inspired ideas, who is very motivated to be teaching the Dharma, but they start to stray away from what you could call like purely Dharmic ideas, and certainly straying away from mainstream Sri Ratna ideas. So, they can kind of begin to lose touch with some of the basic principles of Sri Ratna. Again, in situations where you're very isolated, somebody feels that we have to act from our own kind of inspirations, but you can start to kind of go a bit funny. So this is a way that I feel kind of the lineages can get broken as well. So when I returned to Venezuela 5 years ago after I set up the centre, I found that the order member who's running the centre is teaching the 11 precepts. he didn't teach metta and mindfulness. He taught this meditation based around the respiration, around the breathing, but using a kind of image of a stupor, and essentially it's a kind of tantric Theravada that has been practiced there. So all this inspiration, but it's kind of veering away a lot from our ideas of a communality of practice. Mm. What I think is interesting is that I think he certainly considered himself to definitely be a disciple of Bhante. And possibly, even though he even resigned from the order now, I think he might actually still consider himself to be a disciple of Bhante. But somehow this individualistic inspiration took him away from what Bhante would have really liked him to have been doing. I don't think he was doing what Bhante would have liked him to be doing. So it can actually be quite subtle, this individualistic inspiration at times. It's not just somebody's rebelling against the powers that be in Sri Ratna or whatever. They could actually feel that they're transmitting the lineage of inspiration, but it's becoming subtly distorted because it's kind of quite individualistic. I think a danger sign of this type of this near enemy of inspiration can be when people start talking about how their centre is better than other Sri Ratna centres. That's something they used to have with Croydon. That's what I used to hear a little bit in Venezuela. I occasionally heard it in Mexico as well. So it could happen, particularly in isolated situations. Okay, so those are near and far enemies of inspiration. So responsibility. I think the far enemy is not taking or dropping responsibilities. And so when I left Venezuela 20 years ago, there were sort of some danger signs there, but I didn't want to interact with it. So I think I dropped all responsibility for the situation. I didn't carry on with any responsibility with the centre at that point, and perhaps it was not possible for me to do so anyway. But if no one takes up the responsibility and just drops it, that's the far enemy of responsibility. I think that can also have more subtle forms, this far enemy, like where you take on responsibility in a half-hearted way, so that you kind of assume responsibility, you don't really follow it through. Or another danger, which I think is this same far enemy, is taking on too many hats, so that you've got too many different responsibilities. So actually you can't really effectively follow it through because you've got too many responsibilities. So it's not actually... So it's a kind of far enemy of taking on responsibilities, well, it's having too many. And the near enemy of responsibility, I think, is authoritarianism. So it looks like you're taking on responsibility, but something else is actually going on. There are kind of perhaps mixed motives for wanting to take on responsibility. So quite often when I talk about these lineages, I like to propose an alternative terminology for the lineage of responsibility. I like to call it, it's actually the lineage of love. That we shouldn't be taking on responsibility because we're interested in power. We should be taking on responsibility because we care about things. So that's an alternative way of talking about this lineage for me is it's the lineage of love. So if I take on responsibility for a centre or institution, it should be because I care about that situation, not because I want to do things my own way, or I want to have more influence or something like that. And if I take on the responsibility of being somebody's preceptor, it shouldn't be because I want to sort them out. It should be because I love them. Yeah. So, and so, unfortunately, I think in Latin America, you can get this tendency towards this kind of near enemy of taking on responsibility. I think in Latin American society, democracy is weak. So it's much weaker than we can kind of imagine here in the UK. When I first went to Venezuela, it was a democracy. They had elections and that. But the things that kept it being a democracy have, over the course of 20 or 30 years, been eroded, and you can no longer call it a democracy. So it's kind of very easy to slip into kind of an authoritarian way of leading. And sometimes people are not aware of the kind of the alternatives in a way. And again, it can be quite subtle. It can be not necessarily very immediately apparent. In relation to this, I think it's very interesting. I think one of the last direct interventions that Banti made in terms of the principles of the movement was when Damarati stopped being the president of the Preceptors College. I may not be completely clear about exactly what happened, but I understood that the Preceptors College was thinking of re-electing Damarati for a third time, and Banti said, "Oh, I don't think people should have positions of responsibility for more than 10 years." And so it's very interesting. Damarati is doing a fantastic job. He set up the International Council and things like that. But there's something about, that one person holding a position of responsibility for a long time, although they may have a lot of strengths which contribute to a situation, but things start to sort of mould themselves around our character if we're holding on to responsibility. And Banti has always been very, very good at kind of passing on responsibility somehow. He always seems to see another layer of responsibility that he'd need to pass on. So I think that's something that's kind of really crucial, and I can see in Latin America the importance of people following through those principles and really handing on the responsibilities in that kind of way. So I talked about four ways in which I think our lineages can be broken, these four enemies: despondency, individualistic inspiration, just dropping responsibility, and authoritarianism. And so I did think, well, could I come up with some antidotes to each of these? But as I was thinking about it, I felt that the antidote for all of them is actually the same. It's the same antidote for all of them. I almost felt it's like a fifth lineage that we could have. And for me, that is communication. But it's almost like that in Triratna, we've got a very, very strong culture of communication, which comes with quite simple things like dealing with interpersonal difficulties. If I don't get on with somebody, then I go for a walk with them and talk about it. and sometimes those things don't get transmitted. So I see that in Venezuela, that hasn't really been transmitted. People don't know how to deal with it. Consultative decision making. Like we've got a kind of very strong culture of talking through decisions, getting everybody, all the interested parties involved, finding a way of getting on board, modifying the proposals. If you're a long way away and you've never had the experience of that going on, people don't know about that, and it's another thing and I think these things could directly counteract these enemies also. Rejoicing in merit, a kind of way, just positive communication about people. And so when I arrived back in Venezuela, all I heard was criticism, and so I did rejoice in, and people hardly knew what to do. It's something very integral in our kind of cultural communication that can overcome a lot of these difficulties. And the whole idea that through communication, through the practice of Sangha, we can overcome the subject-object dichotomy. You know, so it's not just about sitting there in meditation. So you can have people with a very, very strong meditation practice, but they somehow haven't imbibed that culture of communication that we've gotten through that. So that's sort of what I feel I'm trying to do as a president, is a kind of is transmit a bit this lineage of communication and through that overcome the, or try to stop the wave coming down too quickly, or try and make little waves, upward waves. And also, that's, I think that's why I'm here as well. I very much liked what you said, Kulavitcha, about that we're all flawed. So I'm part of this wave of degeneration. So like, by coming here and participating in our lineage of communication, then I'm renovating something within myself. But if I just sort of try and go on doing this all by myself, I'm completely incapable of being a president. Even less so in a really difficult situation in Venezuela. It's like really, really challenging. So for me, when I was talking about being a president with Dhammapriya, and he said, one of the things you really need to do is to take part in the president's meeting. I thought, fantastic. That is what would make it possible for me to do the job. So I'm very, very pleased to be here, and I'm really hoping that that's what I'll be getting from being here in that meeting. But thank you very much.
Wow. What an incredibly rich, thoughtful, sobering talk. Really insightful about, well, certainly Latin American centres, but more generally as well, the need to take responsibility, us flawed beings. I love this idea of the lineage of love and all of those things about communication and positive rejoicing. They thread into that, don't they? So, and, you know, Badranath is a man who puts his shoulder behind it. We all know that. The difficulties in Venezuela are extraordinary. I know how difficult it's been, so sadly. So Badramati tried to sidle out of me saying something nice about her, but I pinned her down. My first sighting, LBC. She was one of the offering goddesses. They used to ascend that sort of spiral. Was it spiral, or was that just my imagination? Seems like a spiral staircase up to that office, which is now the office where Bhante was living, bringing food up for Bhante for his lunch, and me, actually, on occasion. But no, I've gotten to know Subhadramati through the exec, and she's delightful, as everybody knows, full of really positive, always positive, glass half full woman. And just works so hard. I mean, I've never seen anybody working so hard to spread the Dharma, and particularly for young people. It just seems like a passion. It's got almost in your DNA. I mean, I work hard, but I get paid for it. She's living out of a suitcase because I picked her up in Birmingham yesterday. She said, "Oh, this is all I own." I thought, "Oh dear," I feel humbled. So, it's about the market.
Thank you. Okay. Great. Thank you, Paramahansa. That's really a very nice introduction. Oh gosh, I've got so much from the other two talks. I'm dying to respond to it. So stimulating, really, really great. It's great to, I'm sure we'll have lots of good lunch and group conversations. So I really liked what Paramahansa, when you said yesterday, and it's been echoed, about just the inspiration, responsibility, just not being separate and ideally co-arising. And it really reminded me of one of Bantu's poems when he talks about a flower and the scent of a flower. And then when you said about love, I thought, oh yeah, that's it. Like the scent of a flower is like the love. It's like a flower doesn't have to try to smell nice. It just does, you know, that's like the love. And yeah, basically they're working together creatively. I really like that double helix model as well, Kulamitra. Because I was thinking that although we present them as four lineages, they're really not like train tracks side by side. They are like weaving in. And given that, I think mostly what I'm going to talk about personally is the path of responsibility for me and how that's had a massive effect on me. And I've always been drawn to that. And it's only looking back, I think my psyche needed that. That my psyche sort of somehow knew that I had to create a situation or situations like where life was working on me. You know how people say that thing of what you're working on in your dark life or something? I never ever knew what the answer to that was. It never, but actually what I more and more think is, yeah, you have to create a situation where you're being worked on. I think somehow I must have known that intuitively. I think especially like as somebody who's like not had kids myself and never wanted to have children, maybe I think it's particularly important if you haven't got children, actually. You have to create something that's equivalent to that somehow. So, of course, when I talk about responsibility, I mean responsibility in relation to other people. So I was going to talk about three things that I think that has brought into my life. Being allowed to take responsibility. Actually, that's interesting. I think Tri Ratna has been a place that's allowed me to take responsibility where nothing else in my life up until that point had. You know, I remember that really clearly, volunteering in the cherry orchard before I even worked there and realising, oh yeah, you can take as much responsibility as you want. Nobody's ever going to stop you doing that. And how important that was to me. So I think what that's brought me, well, I hope it has brought me these things. I hope it's brought me some human maturity. I hope. It's definitely refined my ethical sense, definitely, definitely, and it's definitely reveals to me the work that still needs to be done. So I'll just talk about each of them in turn. So I think on the human maturity level, I was remembering a little incident that concerned Ratna Ghosha, who was a chair at the time of the LBC when this happened. So I was a Mitra. I was teaching meditation in a local college, the Queen Mary College, along with Vajra Chakshu. We were both Mitras. And then we'd been doing it for a while, and then I'd been invited to be ordained. And the little class, I mean, only had about four people, like, maximum in the class, although two order members did emerge from that class. But anyway, yeah. It only had four people in it. And I one day I just went in and I said, oh, by the way, this is my last class. Like, I'm not coming back. You know, be another different person next week. And as I said that, I just looked at one man's face and it completely fell. And I thought, oh, God, like, I'm his meditation teacher. And I've just said this thing in a throwaway way. And I remember telling this to Ratna Ghosha, and Ratna Ghosha said, yes, that's why we usually have order members teaching, because you have to. It's not just about teaching. I mean, I know we all know this, but that was my first time learning it. It's about realizing that you're going to mean something to somebody. And I think that was the first time I started to see more clearly my own agency in the world. And to me, I think that is a mark of maturity. Of course, we're always having an effect, but most of the time we don't realise that. But I definitely felt, oh God, I realised that. And it's almost like something to bear, isn't it? Like that, you know, when I think of that man, and, you know, inside you're just thinking, oh, it's only me, it doesn't matter if it's another different person, they'll probably be better than me, blah, blah. But for him, I'm his meditation teacher, and you have to sort of bear that skillfully. And I think that's definitely maturing. That's definitely matured me. And I've tried to remember that. I've not always succeeded, but tried to remember that. Also, I was thinking it's maturing because, well, basically you have to do hard things. And I mean, I've had to do nothing near as hard as some of you here. you have to do hard things and things you'll be blamed for. And again, like, you know, what I've had to do in that respect is quite modest. I was thinking most recently, you know, I started this little community with Kusla Sara, my friend, for young women in their 20s. And quite soon it emerged. Well, basically, over, in quite quick succession, I had to sort of encourage, even ask, like, two people to leave that community. I knew I had to do it. I knew if I don't do this, the community's gone. You know, it's not going to work. Terribly difficult, isn't it, to have to do it? So much of you wants to go, I don't want to do it, kind of find an excuse not to do it. You've got to do it, and you know you'll be blamed for it. And you blame yourself for it, actually. You know, you torture yourself thinking, was I too cruel or harsh or something? But I think you've got to do that if you take responsibility. I think, oh, I wish I could talk about that more. Anyway, maybe that's a test of whether you've, just thinking as I speak, whether you've fallen into authoritarianism or it's genuine responsibility if you're prepared to do the difficult thing. I don't know. And that, but that's maturing, isn't it? I always remember when I had to, when I became a public preceptor and had to tell somebody they weren't ready to be ordained when everyone else thought they were, and Ratnadharani thought, oh yeah, you really are a public preceptor now, because you've had to do that hard thing, you know. And like, you're totally never ready for it. You know, I think you said this as well, Kula Mitra, like, you can never be ready for the responsibility you've got to take, you know. I remember Sangapala saying that to me when I was going to Dublin as a new order member. He said, don't wait till you're ready to take that step, because you never will be ready to do it. You sort of become ready by doing it. So that's a little bit on, hopefully, maturity. Then the thing I'm definitely sure about, that it refines one's ethical sense. And again, I've got another story involving Ratnagosha in terms of this, because having, like, you know, struggled and still struggle with, like, temper and irritability myself, I said to Ratnagosha once, do you ever lose your temper, Ratnagosha? He was chair of the LBC, and Ratnagosha said no. He said, not temperamentally, I don't, but you, well, this is all right quoting you, Ratnagosha. But you also said, it would just be a really, really big thing if I lost my temper, because I'm the chair at the centre. Again, that's a sort of obvious, isn't it? But again, I think I really took that to heart, and I've tried to use that as a guide, like, loads of times unsuccessfully, but the more you are responsible in relation to other people, then the more the heighten the effects of your actions are, which is horrible, you know, like, in a way, horrible to realise that from my point of view, but also, like, very, very good, because it's been the strongest motivator for me out of every single thing I've tried to do to be a less bad-tempered person. The strongest motivator has been seeing the effect on other people. Which, of course, is always there. Do you know what I mean? It's not that suddenly has made that happen, but it shows up far, far more. So I think, for me, trying to take that on board, it is a shift in consciousness then, realising that. The more I can realise that, the more it's a shift in consciousness, and the more it's... Well, the more it affects one's conscience, thinking about conscience being an aspect of consciousness, it's what it does, and I think I, like, totally need this, is it sort of externalises one's conscience, because you see those effects just much, much bigger. And I've come to think, I know this isn't the usual meaning of apatrapia that we have, but I've come to think as a form of apatrapia, because it is externalised in that way. And yeah, as I say, I feel like I definitely need that. Like, left to my own devices, and my conscience just isn't tender enough, you know, isn't, the sensibility isn't strong enough, just left to my own devices. But in relation to someone else, seeing how they're affected by my unskillfulness, seen that it's more acute, the more responsibility I've taken in relation to them. Like if I'm their preceptor or Kalyana Mitra or Mitra convener or retreat leader or something, then it definitely, at its best, helps, like lifts me up, you know, out of my mire of usual kind of state that I'm in. So it's been very, very important. It's been very, very important for me that it's definitely made my conscience more tender. It's definitely made me realise more deeply, like, that my actions have consequences. I know we know that and we say it, our actions have consequences, but at the same time as saying it with our mouths, our voices, we'll always be defending ourselves against the consequences of our actions because it's so painful. Well, you know, I find that I'm always like justifying myself, the defense of justification, and I don't know, I suppose that is the main defense, isn't it? Why do we not forgive? Very interesting, isn't it? Why we don't forgive? Because we're defending something, and you know, we've just got to stop doing that, really. And yes, so being responsible in relation to other people, especially in those formal ways, has helped me. And it's definitely, the third thing, it's definitely revealed the work still to be done. And I think the two main examples I've got of this, I'm sure there's more, is the first time I conducted a private ordination. That was between the private and the public ordination of this person is where I experienced the biggest doubt I've ever had or ever been conscious of, I should say. It must have been there unconsciously all along. I never really thought I had any doubt. Obviously, I did. And that time, it really, really showed me that. It really, really showed that I had been sort of flying on borrowed wings and living off others' conviction and inspiration and didn't have my own, wasn't nearly deep enough. But there I was, literally in the middle of this ordination ceremony. I had to find it. I had to find something that was mine and not the conviction of, you know, all the people I looked up to, Ratnadarni and Padmasuri and Parami. I had to find my own conviction that the ordination was a thing that was worth doing somehow. It was another one of the experiences. It was quite horrible at the time, but very, very good. And I absolutely know I wouldn't have discovered that level of doubt had I not been in that ceremony. I would have just like gone around going, oh yeah, I'm like really inspired, I don't have doubt, you know. But it sort of drew it up like a, I don't know, like I don't know what the image is, like something that got sunk into me and it drew it up. And then the other one was writing a book. So I've only written one book. I know some of you have written more. But it's such a thing. Again, like you're right in the public domain. God, I remember the first time I opened it. What a weird feeling that there was these words in the book. But it was like me who'd written them. You're right in the public domain. You've taken a stride into the world. You're right into the worldly winds. You know, you get a lot of praise, but people just completely feel they can, like, criticise you as well. But actually, apart from the worldly winds, it wasn't even that. The effect it had on me, I think, was something about, you're just kind of going, into the world. And as part of the book launch, every time I did a little talk about the book, I used to have the most extreme nightmares. It was the worst sleep I ever had. I'd have this terrible nightmare again and again that I had utterly disgraced myself in front of the whole order by losing my temper and, you know, I don't know, attacking someone in the middle of an order convention or something like that. And then I feel like just totally disgraced and thrown out the order in my dream. You know, that feeling when you wake up and think, oh my God, and then, oh, it's only a dream, the relief, you know. Sometimes I'd have those double ones where you'd wake up into another dream and be like, oh my God, it wasn't a dream this time, it's really true. But then luckily it was still a dream. And I remember telling Subhuti about that, and he says, he said, oh, those dreams are showing you that you're not yet in possession of your anger. It's in possession of you. And actually, I still feel that. I'm not yet in possession of it. It's in possession of me. But I felt like writing the book somehow showed me that a little more clearly. So they're the three things, three areas where I think the taking responsibility in relation to others have helped me to be hopefully a bit more mature, definitely made my conscience more tender, definitely revealed the work still to be done. So I haven't really said anything about the lineage of inspiration, but I want to for the last little bit. I was thinking about my relationship with Bhante, which did mainly, in a personal way, consist of taking his lunches up to Bhante and Paramartha, and just met him a few times. And already by the time I was involved, which was 35 years ago, he'd already wasn't really giving public talks and so on. So I definitely didn't really get to know him personally or through his talks. So it's been through my imagination, really, that I've got to know Bhante. I love Chintamani's picture of the refuge tree that we've got on the shrine with Bhante, like, handing that kesa down. I really love that. I was in Dublin looking at some Iranian art in the Chester Beatty Library recently, and in the Iranian art, they have quite often they have a person that offering a drink or something, a goblet of wine, and there's no other person in the picture. And, you know, the explanation is, of course, it's been offered to you, the viewer. And I think that is that with the kesa. There's no one in the picture receiving the kesa, but that's because it's us receiving the kesa from Bhante. And I think, for me, that really communicates, you know, in the first line of what was the Western Buddhist Order, that what Bhante started was an order, not an organisation. And I think where the helix sort of meets for this on me is the responsibility is, how do I communicate that to people who never now will meet Bhante? I met him very little, but then all the people that I'm in contact with from now onwards, and the new people coming along and so on, won't ever meet him. So what is going to communicate that that lineage of inspiration, especially in connection with Bhante? And I definitely see that as my responsibility. So because my relationship with, well, with Bhante himself, but also with Bhante in his form of handing that kesa down, my relationship with that is going to affect everyone I meet. There was a lovely little moment last year during lockdown. There was a little symposium of talks from young people, and one of them was a young Irish woman, and she was talking about, you know, she never met Bhante, he'd already died by the time she came along. And she said for her, Bhante wasn't just a gateway into the transcendental, that he himself was the transcendental object for her. And I talked to the order members in Dublin afterwards. I was really rejoicing in them, because I thought, I could clearly see that was because that was those order members, Vajrasur and Yanadhara, Sadai Sihi. It was their relationship with that that had set up that vibration for her. It couldn't have been otherwise. It was very, very striking to me that. And it is quite subtle, isn't it? It's something like a vibration or an atmosphere or a perfume. I did visit Bhante a couple of times before he died, and one of them I was quite sort of exercised about this whole thing about discipleship, and Bhante had just put his little addendum and said, you know, okay, it's fine if you don't want to call yourself a disciple of mine, you know, but I think he says something like, but, you know, would be kind of natural for you to feel gratitude, because, like, I did set up the movement kind of thing. And I felt so embarrassed, you know, that he had to say that. And also I felt when I went to see Bhante, I went, oh, I've seen old Bhante, gratitude's not enough. People should feel devotion and reverence to you, surely. And Bhante said, he said something, he was very skillful. He said, you can't argue people into positive emotion. He says, but you can allow them to catch it from you. I thought that was very, very good. And I thought, and then I thought, maybe so many ways you could define our job as presidents, and there's probably, they're all right, aren't they? There was many of the sort of, many of them as there are of us. But I thought that could be a way of thinking of our real job as presidents, as to, yeah, to sort of allow people to catch that spirit of the lineage of inspiration through Bhante. And I thought it could be to embody and live out this creative tension between inspiration and responsibility. And I think we've really got that through the other speakers, that they're connected and that it's a tension, and that how do we make that tension a creative tension and not a reactive one. I think it's important that we do keep it as a tension, otherwise it would just collapse, you know. But how do we how do we keep it as a tension, and how do we keep it as a creative one rather than a reactive one? Maybe that could be a question for us to think about in our groups. So that's me. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Subhadramati. The thing that struck me was that, you know, I suppose these two lineages can seem like two, Yoganada, maybe in some ultimate sense, but in sort of a relative sense. I mean, I thought that was wonderful, that first part of your talk, because the image that came to mind were two tectonic plates driving and creating heat and fire and something wonderful coming out of that fault, mountain ranges, and, you know, as you said, maturity, self-awareness, ethical sensitivity, and courage, actually. That's the thing I was left with, courage. Yeah, to put yourself out there demands a lot of courage. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you to all the speakers. Just really rich, really wonderful.